See Rome Vault Podcast, episode number 372. Sunday, July 19th, 2020.
The light of consciousness shines on everyone, but not everyone gains access to the vault.
Hey, everybody. This episode of the See Rome Vault podcast consists of an interview that I recorded just this morning with Kevin. You've heard Kevin here on the See Rome Vault podcast before, but you won't hear him on the main See Rome podcast because he is not a public figure. He doesn't even have any social media accounts because that makes one vulnerable to, well, that gives you the vulnerabilities of a public figure, which he is not. He is looking after his own well-being, so he's doing us a favor by sharing his thoughts here behind the paywall. In general, I ask you, not to circulate these See Rome Vault conversations more widely. I can't stop you from doing so, but in this instance, I particularly ask that you keep it here, in the private space, in the small room of the See Rome. All right, before we start, I just want to spell some names out for you so that if you're not in a position to access the show notes, but you do want to look up some of the figures that we are talking about. First, we're going to be discussing a book by, I think it's Ibram X. Kendi. That's I-B-R-A-M, middle initial X, last name K-E-N-D-I. We'll also talk about the work of Adolf Reed Jr. Adolf Reed is spelled just like it sounds. Also, James Mendez Hodes. So James Mendez is spelled as you'd expect, last name H-O-D-S. That's Hotel Oscar Delta Echo Sierra. And then the tough one. I did watch a video on how to pronounce her name. I'm probably still going to get it wrong. It's Ijeoma Oluo. So first name, I-J-E-O-M-A. Last name, O-L-U-O. Also, I will try to pull the name of an institution out of my memory and absolutely fail to in real time. What I was looking for was the CUNY, or C-U-N-Y, City University of New York School of Labor and Urban Studies, otherwise known as the Murphy Institute, named after Joseph S. Murphy. And I was contrasting that with presentations and gatherings put on by the New School. In particular, the New School hosts an annual gathering called Platform Cooperatism Consortium. And this is where I, first encountered the really off-putting academic speak. And this is the sort of language that I think I sometimes unfairly conflate with critical theory. But I have been to a number of these annual gatherings, and when the presentations are good, they tend to be really good. And with each year, I think the percentage of good presentations grew and the percentage of BS academic gibberish decreased. All right, so for the next hour, you will hear three voices: mine, Kevin's, and that of the late Christopher Lee, playing Saruman the White. I suppose four. You'll also hear his name repeated back to him in answer to the question, "Whom do you serve?" by the leader of his Uruk-hai army. All right, here is my conversation with Kevin, which resulted from a lot of back-channel communication, not just with Kevin, that happened in response to comments that I made in a recent podcast. I think the context will become clear as you listen to the conversation. Here we go.
So you had a chance to review the summary of the book.
I did. Yeah, there's a YouTube video. It's 25 minutes long, and it's just executive summary of the main points, I guess.
Okay, cool. Yeah, so I'm curious about what you think, since you've reviewed it, and you put this as the meeting invitation on here is Kevin's book report. So I was like, oh, I got to explain this to him. But so it'll be nice to have some common ground to walk through. But I think that do we want to review it, like just the framework? Because I think the framework is really interesting, and I think it has some strengths and weaknesses. And I think that it's useful to contrast against other frameworks of racism that I've encountered, and I assume that you've encountered too.
I've certainly encountered racist attitudes, particularly among my friends growing up in Kansas City. The most vociferous racist person I know in real life, like who has a longstanding connection to my life, was my best friend from the fourth grade on. And his family moved to Missouri from Philadelphia. So, you know, the worst white racists I've ever met were German Americans from Philadelphia.
Yeah, yeah. So that's interesting to me because, like, what I liked about this Kendi book, How to Be an Anti-Racist, was I find it far more useful and I think far more realistic than what I understand to be the current progressive conception of racism and I guess anti-racism. Like, I grew up at a certain time in a certain place, and I was told, this is what race is, this is what racism is. I identified myself with the political left wing, and I've seen over the course of my adulthood, the definition of racism change and this concept of anti-racism emerge. And I actually found the whole thing pretty discouraging. But if you want to be in the political left wing, you can't really talk about that, you know? Especially if you're a white person. So, specifically,
what is it that you can't say?
So there is a conception, and I'm trying to think about when I first saw it, but it's the idea that racism is only something that white people can do. Okay? Mm-hmm. And that's like, when I've poked at that, when I've looked at it, I've read about it, I understand that construction, but I think that it's wrong, and I think that it's so wrong that it actually is counterproductive and has negative effects. And what I liked about the Kendi framework is that his framework is flexible enough to allow for racism going back and forth, but also he explicitly identifies anti-white racism as a type of racism, and he admits to having been an anti-white racist himself at one point. Now, I want to back this up. I want to say that, like, racism against white people and racism against black people are not equivalent. They're not the same thing because of all these complicated historical factors. But it's just a breath of fresh air to have somebody who is emerging as the leader, as the literal subject matter expert on this, be so transparent and clear in his thinking about it.
So let's talk about Ibram X. Kendi for a moment. In the introduction, we can assume that I've given the full title of his book, but I don't know where I got this into my head, but when I started to listen to the summary of the book, I thought that he was a Fox News commentator. And a black guy on Fox News, like Juan Williams used to host Talk of the Nation on NPR.
Yeah.
And, Fox needed some black representation, and they wrote him a big check. And he said, see you later, NPR. I'm going to go make a bunch of money on Fox News.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's a particular predilection to sell out, I guess. With any black personality that I associate with Fox News, you know, there, if you are a well-spoken black person and you want to calm conservative people and say, look, black people really do have faults. The black community really has some shortcomings. You have reason, you know, to have negative attitudes about some aspects of the black community. You can make a bunch of money. You know, white people will pay you a lot of money to say that in front of civic organizations, churches, whatever.
Yeah.
So that's when I started listening to the audiobook, that's where I thought he was coming from. And then I listened to the summary and I thought, well, that's pretty thoroughgoing and honest and rigorous, you know, for somebody coming from Fox News. And then I went to his Wikipedia page and I find no mention of Fox News. So I don't know where that notion came from, but it really colored my expectations going into the summary.
Yeah, that's strange. I don't think he's been on Fox News. I've seen him on Democracy Now, you know, and the overlap between Fox News and Democracy Now, I guess, is probably really small. Yeah.
I'm very small. I imagine only people who are making a deliberate effort to take in a diversity of viewpoints would be listening to both of those sources.
I can imagine a certain type of commentator that would have ended up on RT in like maybe 2014 being on both you know, Fox News and Democracy Now. Like, you know, that certain class of American dissident who was really hard on Obama, you know, like, and if you were hard enough on Obama at a certain point, you could get it airing on Fox News.
Right. Like, Chris Hedges.
Exactly. Exactly. Not that I know if he's ever been on Fox News or not.
He's certainly been on InfoWars. He's, you know, his message fits right into the Alex Jones worldview very nicely. Alex Jones was just worshipful of Chris Hedges.
You know, and I don't, I mean, I thought Chris Hedges' whole thing was that he was an old school, classicist, credible intellectual. Like, I thought that was his whole thing. Like, he talks about, like, Greek tragedies and compares them with the tragedy of the contemporary condition of the United States. And I just would assume that something like just deranged propaganda like InfoWars would be beneath him, you know?
Or he would have. The thing is, deranged propaganda usually has some element of sense to it. And, you know, if somebody who is not deranged, or at least not particularly deranged, I mean, Chris Hedges has his extremism.
Yeah.
But, you know, if like a good lie is going to be 90% the truth, it's going to incorporate obvious true facts about the world into it. Mm-hmm. So Chris Hedges has a really strong anti-federal government rant that he can produce at will.
Okay.
And Alex Jones has a use for that.
Yeah. And like, to be the most fair, I suppose I can be to Alex Jones, is like, work like his in any conspiracy driven narrative, it always resonates with a certain type of emotional truth, you know. Like, your average info warriors person, they know deeply on a deep level that like things are screwed up, you know, and that they're being taken advantage of. And that is basically the case for a lot of, I would dare say, the majority of people under our current social constructions, you know. And but I think that when it comes to attributing the source and the cause of dysfunction, I think that it's, you know, that's where the derangement comes in.
Now, 2020 has been a bizarre year in so many ways. And one of them is it has been an enormous vindication for Alex Jones in that he has been, you know, articulating this, the elites are all pedophiles narrative for over a decade. And, you know, Jeffrey Epstein has been, he's demonstrably connected to high-level people in government and industry and finance. And his network is, you know, it is the most powerful people in the world. And there, apparently the evidence that he has collected on the activities of his peers was enough to get him killed, unless you believe he did commit suicide, you know, in his jail cell.
That's one of those things where, like, I'm trusting the experts on this because I don't want to go down that rabbit hole and die on that hill. I do want to talk about Kendi's book and that framework, but I do want to respond to a couple things that you just said. Like, the Epstein thing is fascinating. It is terrifying. And I think, honestly, it's just getting started, and not just Epstein. Like, there has been, in the same way that there have long been rumors about Prince Andrew and that the rumors about, you know, Jeffrey Epstein and Bill Clinton and things like that and Trump, there have been longstanding rumors of a large pedophile ring inside Hollywood. And nobody's been talking about that with Epstein. And I wonder if it's actually not connected, you know, assuming that there is a large-scale pedophile ring inside of Hollywood, which I think is, unfortunately, tragically plausible, given the priorities of Hollywood and how that machine functions out there. You know, I think that it might be something that comes out eventually, you know, not just Harvey Weinstein, you know, the level of sexual predation in that industry, I think, is probably pretty enormous.
So let's get back to Ibram X. Kendi. And what's the full title of his book?
His book, he's written a couple books, but the book we're going to discuss today is called How to Be an Anti-Racist.
And that's okay? The full title?
That is the full title, yeah.
That's very unusual. Publishers like to have titles which are paragraphs under themselves to, you know, hit all the keywords and to appeal to the algorithms.
Yeah. And so he previously wrote a book called Stamped from the Beginning.
Short title.
Yeah. which if I understand correctly, was basically the pop version of his doctoral thesis. I don't actually know what his doctorate is in, but Kendi does have a PhD. I believe it's from Temple University. And he did the long slog work of like basically investigating the modern conception of race, where it started, all the different manifestations of it, and wrote this book called Stamped from the Beginning. All right. I've not read that book, but he refers to it in How to Be an Anti-Racist. And, you know, I did the usual Wikipedia reading stuff that you do when you're familiarizing oneself with another's work when you don't have the time to actually do all the reading. So since then, so How to Be an Anti-Racist was 2019, actually. And he's got a couple derivative works of it. Like, I mean, derivative, literally deriving from the core text, not necessarily like saying that it's not good work. I haven't read those either. Once a children's book about anti-racism, you know, for his framework. And another one is called, I think it's called Anti-Racism and You, and it's a co-authored thing. So he writes this book in 2019. I probably saw it on the bookstore shelf. It passed kind of beneath my interest. And then obviously George Floyd is murdered by the police in an extremely terrible way. This reminds everybody of all the other Black individuals who are murdered by the police in extremely terrible ways, and this longstanding problem. And that kind of mixes with the pent up rage of being locked up in your homes for 3 months and I guess not having it amount to any good given where we are right now with COVID. And so people, you know, people who are getting on in years like yourself, and I dare say myself, who don't feel safe taking to the streets and have other commitments, you know, it's like, what do you do? And so all of a sudden, you know, everybody I know is talking about this book. I tried to do the, you know, the decent thing and check in with my friends of color and some of my African-American coworkers who I have enough affinity with to broach the subject and say like, hey, how you doing with all this? I know this is going to be impacting you differently than it's impacting me, you know? So there's like basically like a book list of stuff that white people are supposed to read. And I'm like, okay, you know, I am...
You're doing your due diligence.
I'm going to do my due diligence. You know, like I had previously been turned off by a lot of what I saw as cutting edge progressive thought about racism and race. I thought it was really backwards and really counterproductive. And we could get into that. And so I was very reluctant to pick up this book, but I did. And as I said in the email that kind of spurred this conversation between, I was really surprised. Because this is not, I mean, well, and it makes sense to me, given like the level of rigorous research and education that this guy has, that it's a lot, there's a lot more to his thought than you would get from, you know, like a Twitter clapback from a lot of self-proclaimed anti-racists.
You want to define Twitter clapback?
So
I'm on Twitter, but I'm not of Twitter.
Yeah, okay. So, and I'm not even on Twitter, okay? My understanding of clapback, though, is like when somebody posts something and for whatever reason you disagree with it, and since Twitter's a public forum and anybody can respond, you know, down in comment, sometimes it's comment one, sometimes it's comment 348, there's this burning, you know, like searing, concise, pithy, witty, little dismissal, you know? Like a direct response and a dismissal. My understanding, that's a clapback. Okay.
Okay.
Like this is the type of stuff that AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, is like really good at, you know, and this is why I think she's so beloved within a certain sphere of progressivism. Well, I, you know, beyond just her actual voting district, because she's so social media savvy and literate. And this, I've, you know, I think I actually learned the term clapback from reading a BuzzFeed article about her or something.
Hey, everybody, I'm just jumping in here after the fact with the Merriam-Webster definition of clapback. U.S. informal, a quick, sharp, and effective response to criticism, not to be confused with a garden variety diss. A clapback is deemed by most as a targeted, often viciously acute comeback intended to place someone in much-needed check. The goal of the clapback is to shut it down. Clapbacks are now so much part of our regular discourse online that even your humble dictionary has been accused of clapping back. Clapback is a noun that derives from an earlier verb, clap back, which refers to the same thing, responding to a criticism with a withering comeback. The term ultimately derives from a 2003 song by Ja Rule, appropriately titled Clap Back. The phrase is the meat of the hook. Clap back, we gon' clap back. Which answers what Ja Rule and his crew will do to rappers who disrespect them. The song is a diss track, or a song written primarily to diss another rapper or a competing rap label. Clap back, two words, is aimed at rappers 50 Cent and Eminem, and is just one of many diss tracks released in the beef between Murder, Inc. Records, the label Ja Rule was on, and Shady Records, which signed 50 Cent and was owned by Eminem. The clapping here isn't literal. Ja Rule references another rap to explain what clapping back is. All these wangsta snitches let the Nina, 9mm handgun, blow kisses. And she somehow misses. He gon' miss the mistress and clap that boy like Birdman and Clips. Clap That Boy is a reference to Birdman's 2000 song What Happened to the Boy, featuring Clips, and on the eponymous album Birdman, in which the boy in question snitched and, quote, we put a clap into that boy, close quote. You may think the clap in question is the well-known clap that means a sudden blow. It's not. In this context, clap refers to shooting someone. The word refers to the sound of a handgun shot. It shows up in rap lyrics back in the early 1990s. Liggedly, let the nines clap cause I'm black, from EPMD, featuring Das EFX, coming at ya on Business Never Personal, 1992. And my lyrical format sounds like the gun claps. Redman, De Journey, on Dare is a Dark Side, 1994. By 2000, clap wasn't just referring to the sound of a gun, but to the act of shooting someone. Clap whoever stand between Sean and figures. That's from Jay-Z intro on The Dynasty, Rock La Familia, 2000. A clapback, then, is return fire, whether literal or, as is more the case today and on Twitter, metaphorical. All right, now back to the conversation with Kevin. So let us get into the summary of ideas and arguments presented by Ibram X. Kendi in his book, How to Be an Anti-Racist.
Sure, sure. So the book is very thorough, very carefully constructed, and each chapter opens with a definition or definitions. And he explores those definitions both with research, okay? Its book is thoroughly footnoted, okay? And also examples from his own life or his family history. And so when he's talking about racism, he talks about not just racism that he has experienced as a black man, but also racism that he has perpetuated as a person. And so, as I had said, I was very skeptical of it, based on the title, because of what I'd seen presented as anti-racist thought. And when I open up the book, he says, oh, you can only be one of two things, a racist or an anti-racist. And I kind of rolled my eyes and groaned, okay? Because when somebody tries to split the entire world into two categories, I immediately raise objection, right? But then what the rest of the book he does is he further divides this category of racist into subcategories. He teases out all the nuances and how it interacts with different social categories, okay? And he also provides corresponding definitions of anti-racism along those lines. But this is the most important thing, I think, from the book, and it's in the first chapter, and I think it's so important, I thought it's so important to review that I actually wrote it down, all right? And I'm just gonna read it, okay? So the first definition, he says, is racist is one who is supporting a racist policy through their actions or inaction or expressing a racist idea. He says anti-racist is one who is supporting an anti-racist policy through their actions or expressing anti-racist ideas. Very clean cut, very straightforward, top of the chapter. Deeper into the chapter, but not too far, okay? This is this is setting the tone for the book. He says, racist and anti-racist are like peelable name tags that are placed and replaced based on what someone is doing or not doing, supporting or expressing in each moment. These are not permanent tattoos. No one becomes a racist or anti-racist. We can only strive to be one or the other. All right, So this is important to me because right now we're at a very hot moment for what people call cancel culture. And what is done to people, sometimes famous people, and sometimes ordinary people who made the mistake of trying to have a semi-public presence through their social media, or who had the misfortune to be filmed, okay? People are, the label racist, rightly or wrongly, is attached to them. And it is treated like a permanent tattoo. It is a mark of shame that somebody is going to have. And, you know, this can destroy somebody's life and it can destroy somebody's career, okay? So some people are very, very bad, okay? And some people probably, I don't want to say deserve to have their lives destroyed or deserve to have their careers destroyed, but some people have, you know, perpetuate racism and racist acts, okay, that are pretty vile and you don't have a lot of sympathy for me. But this has been extended into basically an entire person's history. So you have these phenomenon where people are digging up tweets from 10 years ago because Twitter is that old now. And it doesn't matter what a person has done or said since then. If a person strayed from a certain orthodoxy, they are done. They are cancelable. They are off the list of the anointed. Okay? Now, this is not Kendi's thinking. This is what I had seen rising out of a certain type of the progressive left, which I had thought was dangerous and unhelpful. Okay? And I really appreciated from the get-go that he lays this out at the beginning of the text. And so the framework as proposed here does not allow for that. And it does not say that it says the exact opposite. These ideas, okay, and ideas that you have, it's like racist isn't an identity. It's an action.
And it's, I think, not that's a non-material essential quality, which is, it sometimes gets treated as.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's just the start. And I dare say it gets better from there. You know, the book is not without its flaws. And I do think that there are I want to be very careful because I haven't done nearly the research this guy has. And I've only read this book one time and a half. All right. But but that doesn't mean it's beyond critique and I might not have something critical to say about it. But just starting with that, I think that runs kind of counter to what I have thought or what I understood was the progressive consensus definition of racism.
So let's pause and digest this, these opening definitions.
Yeah.
The thing about it that makes me uncomfortable is the idea that at any moment, you are either racist or anti-racist. There is no middle ground. There is no neutral. You're one or the other. And you can be racist by inaction. So, for example, my son is visiting me. He's 15. And, I tell him, and I think he believes, that compared to the really good movies of the 1980s, the general output of Hollywood today is garbage. And so I've been demonstrating this to him by showing him, you know, some of the big films from the 1980s. And, mm-hmm. you know, in the case of Alien, the late 70s, because it came out in 79. But I still consider it a film of the 80s. We watched Predator. If he and I have a discussion about Predator, and we don't focus in on the racial differences and the power dynamics between Carl Weathers and Arnold Schwarzenegger, and we talk about other issues, is that a racist conversation, according to Kendi?
You know, he doesn't talk about pop cultural racism in those terms, and he doesn't say that he never says anything like not using racism as an analytical lens makes you a racist. What I understand to be racist in action is something that I imagine you'll relate to, but I'll talk about myself, okay? So I am actually the same age as Ibram X. Kendi, okay? I was born
in... So you're an elder millennial.
I am a zennial KMO.
A zennial? What's a
zennial? Yeah, that's Generation X and millennial cusp, which means I had an analog childhood, but a digital adulthood, okay? And it's a great place to be, I gotta say, as we're transitioning from an analog to a fully digital world, you know? Like, mm-hmm. I remember cassette tapes and LP records, and I know how to use them, you know? I know how to, but I'm not quite native as your son is, okay, with probably software, but I'm way more comfortable with it than many of my elder coworkers.
Well, there's a big difference between you and my 16-year-old son. I mean, he is a full-on Zoomer.
Oh, yeah, he's a Zoomer, but, like, you know, I don't want to sound like a Facebook meme here, but, I mean, there's probably some analog skills that he does not have that are still useful in our world, you know? Like, I'm not saying this is him, but there are reports of kids who can't read a map because they have Google Maps. They can't actually take a abstract planner representation of a situation and correlate themselves with the kids who can't, like, read a face clock. You know? Anyways, so I'm the same age as Kenty, okay? And you are a Gen Xer. I'm a white guy. Now, something that has happened to me more than once in my lifetime, okay, is I am meeting a white person, okay? And I'm in this get to know you stage and you're doing all the social signaling stuff and that person will say something that's explicitly racist. Okay. Mm-hmm. And I don't say anything about that. All right. And I think this is the type of inaction. Okay. So if somebody is doing something that is not like in the gray area, okay, not in the we're all human flawed area, but if somebody is using explicitly racist language, right, and I as a person of the same background as them don't say anything, but don't say anything against it, I'm giving that person a pass, and I'm also giving him I'm allowing for him to assume that I implicitly agree. Now, has that ever happened to you?
Yes.
Okay, so he does not identify this specific type of inaction, but this is something that I was immediately reminded of, okay? And it's something that I felt challenged by, okay? And I think that, you know, I think that when I have done that in my life, that that's not cool, all right? I just think that that's actually not okay for me to allow that to pass, you know? I don't have to fight a person. Okay, I don't have to put myself at the risk of physical danger, but I could say, hey man, that type of talk is not called for, or you know what, I really don't agree with what you're saying right now.
I'm gonna have us push on here in just a moment.
Yeah.
But since you, and I know this is not part of the content of the book, but since you brought up cancel culture.
Yeah.
I know it's a buzz in the social media sphere, in the alternative media sphere right now, and maybe to some extent even in the mainstream corporate media. I'm not as invested in it as I might be. Mm-hmm. So maybe just a brief introduction to what the concept means and what the controversy is.
Okay, sure. Yeah. And this is really good because I actually wanted to talk about in a specific example of somebody who is a prominent African-American academic who disagrees with Kendi's definition, okay? So cancel culture is, my understanding, it's when you find something that that a person publicly says, all right? And, you know, you label them disagreeable and you try to vote them off, okay? So this is basically an intra-leftist phenomenon, okay? Like I'm sure that like progressive leftists would love to have the power of cancellation over the right wing, but they really don't because like the type of people who support right wing figures don't really care what liberals think. Okay. But, so the example I have in mind with this is there is he is a socialist academic from New Orleans, black guy named of Adolph Reed. Okay. Mm-hmm. Grew up in the Jim Crow South, but he's still hale and hearty. So I'm thinking he's like late 60s, maybe 70. All right. He's a classic socialist from what I understand. Okay. So he is the author of one of those articles I sent you that disagrees with Kendi. Okay. Reed is very critical of the anti-racist framework, and he's, as he understands it, and he's critical of Black Lives Matter. He's even critical of the Black Panther Party. Okay. So Reed says, and Reed has his own definition of racism, all right, which is simply put, the belief that race exists, all right, and he elaborates upon it to say that the belief that there is, what does he say? Racism is the belief that there is a subspecific naturally occurring population within Homo sapiens that exists between the level of the species and the local breeding population, right?
Would you repeat that?
Racism, according to Adolf Reed, is the belief that there is a subspecific naturally occurring population within Homo sapiens that exists between the level of the species and the local breeding population.
Is that the same as race realism?
No.
Okay.
No, race realism is science. Okay. Well, I guess it's definitely related. Okay. Because race realists say would accept that. Race realists like Richard Spencer would say, yeah, that there's something between species and an individual, that there's some sort of biologically significant category, okay? Adolf Reed is not, despite, you know, the unusual nature of his first name, is not at all like aligned with somebody like Richard Spencer. But he's saying that, like, look, like, racism is the belief that there's some sort of meaningful biologically based category that exists beneath the species Homo sapien and above, say, like the local breeding population. So, like, significant in that it actually tells you something about an individual beyond the color of their skin. Okay? So, this is his belief. And as a socialist, he thinks that the left should organize along class lines. All right? So, he was going to give a talk to the Democratic Socialists of America, DSA, chapter in New York City, which is the largest chapter in the United States, okay? And he was just going to give a talk. And there was a large, air quotes around large here, public backlash calling for the literal cancellation of the event because Reed was denounced as a class essentialist, okay? This is to say that he held an opinion that was so abhorrent that he was not deserving of a platform, okay? Now, he doesn't have the same ideas as somebody like Richard Spencer or Milo Yiannopoulos or all those people who tried to troll Berkeley, California, okay? But it's the same tactic. You have an opinion, it's objectionable, it does not agree with our orthodoxy, and therefore we are calling you out and we're trying to shut you down. That's cancel culture. Now, Reed, who is a tenured professor, he doesn't have anything to worry about, okay? But if somebody who is trying to participate in the discussion of the moment, okay, who does not have the type of, does not have a secure platform, or whose employment is dependent upon the generosity of other people, basically, right? Then they're at great risk. An example that comes to mind, I forget the guy's name, I feel very bad for him. He was some sort of data analyst. I think he'd worked for Obama. And when the initial outrage and protests and manifestations against police brutality in the city of Minneapolis, when those moved beyond peaceful protest and property destruction and what some people call looting began to occur, all right? In the thick of that, this guy posts on Twitter just a link with a brief Twitter summation of research by a prominent African American researcher about the riots in the late 60s and early 70s, and about how those riots in response to the death of Martin Luther King and other things. Okay. Could be interpreted through the data as contributing towards the hardening of racial and anti-crime attitudes on the part of white people, okay? So this data guy, all right, all he does is he tweets a brief link to evidence by somebody saying that, hey, maybe rioting is not a great idea if you're trying to reach the larger public with a positive message, okay? Now, this is an opinion. I'm not saying I agree with this, all right? But I'm saying that what happened to this man seems unfair and that his employer was identified, his employer was contacted, and people demand that this man be fired. And this man was fired. So that is cancel culture also. And so there's a lot more to the framework. We started with the top definition of racist and anti-racist, and then he breaks it down even further, which I found very useful, you know? And then he has his own thesis of race and what it is differs from Reed's. And I think that it probably can be made to work with Reed. We could talk a little bit about that, or we can talk about other stuff. I know you reviewed a summary of it as well.
So I just wanted to mention Adolf Reed is 73 years old.
Okay.
Yeah. So you were pretty close. And yeah, I read the piece by Adolf Reed that you sent me, and I find his language a little off-putting.
Yeah.
It smacks of the academic left. And I just had some very bad experiences when I was living in New York City, going to events put on by the New School, mm-hmm. and also what's the other university, the big lefty university in downtown Manhattan? I know there's a couple different universities.
NYU? Often,
no, smaller, not quite as well known. But anyway, mm-hmm. there was the New School and this other entity which mm-hmm. put on free events. And I went to them and was often just really put off by, like, one of them was explicitly about, you know, how platforms like Uber or Amazon Mechanical Turk, you know, these are platforms where somebody can go and do work, and they are designed to keep workers from communicating with one another so that they can't organize. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is a topic that is very meaningful to me, and mm-hmm. I would go, and the presentations were hit or miss. Some of them were actually on that topic, and others were just this gobbledygook of, you know, just leftist academic speak where they're just constantly referencing all these, you know, mid-20th century French intellectuals.
Yeah, yeah. If you're not conversant with Baudrillard, you don't know what the hell's going on.
Right, yeah. Which, you know, and I would contrast these with there was the name's escaping me now, but it used to be just a promise of really good content. There was a sub-school, I think it was a sub-school of NYU. It was a labor studies center. And I'll put in the name when I look it up later, but they would put on presentations, and you know, the promise there was that this content will be of not just interest, but of, you know, absolute bedrock utility to working people in the struggle against, you know, oppression, economic oppression from the elite classes. And it always paid off. It was always just right on, mm-hmm. you know, and that sort of distancing academic gobbledygook never entered into any of their presentations. So,
yeah.
you know, so, I've developed an aversion to even hints of that sort of language.
Yeah, it's definitely academic-ish, but, and I plowed through it, and maybe it's because I just got out of grad school a year ago, like that I'm more comfortable with that. But
well, I plowed through it because when I encounter that sort of language, I think one of two things is going to be true. Either this person has absolutely nothing to say, and it's just an exercise in putting words on paper, you know, because they are required to do what they're supposed to do in life, or they do have something to say, but they want to make it respectable to people who, you know, expect this type of obscurantist language. And Reed's use of that stuff was very minimal. And I fully believe that he had something to say. So I don't resent him for using it. And I pushed beyond my, you know, my initial pushback against it. And I read the whole thing. And, you know, I don't believe for a second that he falls into that first category.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's not the sort of thing that I'm going to be, you know, that I'm going to take the time to familiarize myself well enough to, you know, to be able to summarize in what I consider to be natural, spontaneous language, English language.
Yeah. Yeah. So the thesis of the Reed article, as I understand it, is that more Black people are being killed by the police than white people. All right.
Which is not true.
We're going to have a point of contention on. Well, okay. Let me rephrase that. You're correct. It's not true. Black people are more likely to be killed by police than white people are likely to be killed by police. By total number of people killed by the police, more white people are killed by the police than black people because there are more white people in the country. You're correct. Okay. So, but the idea that like there's, it's this, depending on what study you cite, and it's something I've seen as low as 1.5 to as high as 4 times as likely per capita, all right? So Reed accepts that as true, but he does an analysis of the data, 4-year-old data at this point, because the article does date from 2016. But he's saying that like, but if you sort this correctly, it's mostly because they're poor. So that, so he begins with that. So, you know, being a socialist, okay, that, you know, which is to say he has an interest in the economic, you know, in class, in economics, that's where he starts. And because he holds that opinion is objectionable to large amount, large numbers of the membership of the largest socialist organization in the United States, there was an attempt to cancel him. And they definitely at least canceled that one talk.
Yeah, so they deplatformed him on one occasion. But as you say, he is a tenured professor. He can't get fired for no matter what he says.
Yeah.
So, he is immune from full-on cancellation. Although, you know, at the time that he did get deplatformed or that's the phrase, deplatformed.
Yeah.
I saw repeatedly people on Twitter, you know, denouncing him as a class essentialist, saying that nothing he has to say is of any value because, you know, he is so focused on class to the exclusion of race.
Yeah. And so that's what's really stifling about this whole phenomenon is that if you disagree, I think it's totally fair to call him a class essentialist. And I think it's totally fine if people want to disagree with him. But I, you know, I was raised, maybe it's because I'm a Xennial or whatever, like if you, with the idea that if you disagree with somebody, it is incumbent upon you to provide arguments against what they're saying to disprove them, as opposed to denounce them in a public forum and call upon others to denounce them in a public forum at such a volume as that the decision makers cave to essentially public opinion.
Are you familiar with Christian Parenti?
I am not.
So I'm only familiar with him because somebody that I've been corresponding with on these topics sent me a link to an article by him. He's a professor at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York City. That's where Peter Moskos teaches, who's been on this program a lot. But
is he related to Michael Parenti?
I don't know.
Okay.
But I do know from this introduction, this email introduction that was sent to me, that when he's not in New York City, he lives in Brattleboro, Vermont, which is about a half hour south of here.
Okay.
So I'm going to try to interview him. But he's got an article called The Surprising Geography of Police Killings, Back of the Napkin Calculations on Race, Region, and Violence. And it's really fascinating. And I can't begin to summarize it on the fly because it's complicated. But it starts off with just some, you know, looking at statistics on killings by police, by race in various states. And he compares a lot of Southern states, because, you know, we think of Southerners as being the ugly, bigoted, you know, knuckle draggers. Mm-hmm. And in states like Arkansas, Tennessee, Mississippi, Louisiana, the percentage of blacks killed by police is usually a few points either above or surprisingly even below the representation of blacks in the population at large.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Whereas in places like Massachusetts, blacks are killed at 4 times the rate of their population. And then he goes into a history of why is Yankee racial prejudice so much more vicious and why does it result in death, you know, so much more often than it does in the South. And then he goes into a history of, you know, slavery and the economic systems of the North and South prior to the Civil War. And that's where it gets very interesting, but also more complicated than I can summarize on the fly.
Yeah.
Yep.
So relating this to the Reed article, and then I want to move into a third definition of racism. Okay. I don't have it right in front of me, but I believe he identifies states that have very high percentages of police violence per capita. Okay. And have very low black populations. It's New Mexico and like Colorado and a couple other states out West where he says like a lot of people are killed by police out here and there's barely any black people.
Right.
So like, there's a whole lot going on here, which is, you know, it is at least partially about race and it's also partially about class, but it also does have to do with economic systems and it does have to do with like geography and it does have to do with urban versus rural. And the Kendi framework is much more flexible than honestly Reed's definition, okay, which is just class, okay? Or Reed's analysis of police violence, okay, which is just class-based, all right? And also, it's far more flexible than what I understand to be the progressive, what I understood prior to reading this book to be the progressive definition of racism, right? And now I want to talk about this guy that I didn't actually send you ahead of time because I had to look him up last night, all right? And I'm not trying to pick on this guy because I quite like him because he knows a lot about Dungeons and Dragons. So I thought this might pique your interest, right? Okay. So his name is James Mendez Rhodes, right? He is a mixed race individual. He is by his own published bio stuff. I'm not doxing this guy trying to do anything like that. And he's trying to make himself a public figure, all right? Because he wants to be a cultural consultant for video games, right? And for tabletop games. So, and he wrote a series of articles that I read a couple months ago about racism inside Dungeons and Dragons, right? Which is pretty interesting stuff, and I thought you might get a kick out of it.
I heard an NPR story recently about how Dungeons and Dragons is changing some of their rules and racial descriptions to pacify, you know, the left. I mean, they didn't describe it like that. On NPR, of course, they framed it as, you know, finally these bigoted, awful gamers are making some concessions to, you know, basic human morality.
Yeah. And so, like, so that's interesting because I remember as a kid, like, reading this stuff and thinking, like, and finding it problematic. I don't know if you had the same reaction. I didn't think it was particularly, like, abhorrent, but I'm like, well, they're talking about like orcs and humans as different races, but really they're talking about different species.
That is a pet peeve of mine. It's not just in fantasy gaming or fantasy literature. It also works its way into science fiction, like in Star Trek. You know, Klingons and humans and Vulcans are described as races, when in fact clearly different species evolved on different planets. They have zero genetic similarity in history.
Yeah, and
they're
like
not races.
the value of sci-fi and fantasy, what it can do that other genres can't do, okay, is that you have this great range of concepts to play with and expanded metaphors, okay? So I think that you can do a lot with like talking about like having different types of humanoid, be they different species or whatever, okay? And I don't think we need to get rid of that. But where I do think Dungeons and Dragons is problematic, and this is what Rhodes actually gets into in some of his analysis, is that like it's not just that the characterization of like orcs, okay, isn't just that like they're short or tall or they have dark skin or whatever. It's that they're literally evil. Like, you know, like not only do you call them a race as opposed to a species, you also morally essentialize them based on their biology. So I think you could redo D&D pretty easily by just, you know, stopping the fact, just not say that certain species are essentially evil at their core. Like, and I don't know enough about D&D as this guy, because I'm not trying to be a gaming consultant, but he points out how like it was literally impossible against the core rules to play as an orc for a long time. Like you could play as a half orc, okay? But in order to play as an individual with any type of moral agency, like you were not allowed to play as this type of character.
Okay, at this point, I'm going to insert a clip from The Fellowship of the Ring, the Peter Jackson film.
Okay, oh,
with,
great.
With Saruman, played by Christopher Lee, explaining to the captain of his newly created orc army, or the Uruk-hai, where the orcs came from.
Do you know how the orcs first came into being? They were elves once, taken by the dark powers, tortured and mutilated, a ruined and terrible form of life. And now, perfected by fighting Uruk-hai. Whom do you serve? Saruman.
Yeah.
The initial orcs were elves. who were captured by the dark powers and tortured and perverted until they became evil.
Now, okay. Now,
and Dungeons and Dragons stole orcs. They lifted it directly from Tolkien. I mean, the original Dungeons and Dragons is basically stealing Fritz Lieber, Tolkien, Michael Moorcock, you know, just the fantasy that was popular.
Don't forget Robert Howard. He's a Conan fan. Don't forget Robert Howard.
Certainly. And Lovecraft, definitely.
And Lovecraft, heck yeah.
But they were basically just collecting all of the tropes from popular fantasy literature. You know, it wasn't necessarily written in the 60s and 70s, but it was popular and it was in the zeitgeist in that subculture in the 60s and 70s. There's very little that is original to Dungeons and Dragons from that period.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you're definitely getting some of Tolkien's racism, which you'd be hard-pressed to say that he wasn't in any way a racist.
Okay, I mean, I'm going to butt in here because this is Mendez Rhodes. Like, Mendez Rhodes, as I said, is a mixed-race individual of Asian and white ancestry. And he does this great deep dive where he goes back through Tolkien's literature and letters and stuff and makes a compelling case. I haven't tried to disprove it, that orcs were specifically an anti-Asian archetype. And so he takes this little person. Yeah, he talks about the Mongols, you know. He talks about the colonial, what was going on in the British colonies during Tolkien's life with, like, the rightful rebellion of India and things like that, you know. And so I brought him up, though, because he is one of these people who says that racism is something only white people can do, okay? Now, he is an what he says that, like, and I've seen this articulated elsewhere, that racism is prejudice plus power, okay? And he says that white people might experience racial prejudice, that white people can be treated poorly based upon their perceived race, okay? Because we're going to remember that race isn't actually a real thing, okay? There is no meaningful biological grouping between species and individual. All right. He says that, yeah, white people might experience racial prejudice. All right. And he says, but he says that it isn't racism because white people have all the power. And this is what I understood to be the standard progressive talking point about racism at this point. And I've seen this repeated in other contemporary books about anti-racism. Another one of those books on the list that all good white people are supposed to read right now. It's a pretty good book. It's called So You Want to Talk About Race by this woman from Seattle, her name is Ijoma Uluo, okay? And she says that she offers two definitions of racism, one which is essentially Reed's, which is that racism exists, and the other which is essentially Mendez Rhodes. It says that, like, racism is about prejudice plus power, okay? And she runs with that one. She says, we're going to use this definition of racism.
What's her name again?
It's Ijoma Uluo. Okay, so relating this back to Kendi, one of Kendi's chapters is called Power, right? And the definition at the top of the chapter is what he calls the powerlessness defense, he says, which he defines as the illusory, ceiling, disempowering, and racist idea that black people can't be racist because black people don't have power. And this is one of those things that, like, having taken issue with the progressive standard talking point as articulated by Mendez Rhodes and Ijoma Uluo, that racism is something that only white people can do and that no people of color, including black people, can do it because they don't have power. Seeing Kendi explicitly reject that, I thought was really courageous and I thought actually true. And so in this chapter of going into power, right? He has a really great, he talks about his beliefs that he had, and he articulates his beliefs as saying, quote, I thought only white people could be racist and black people could not be racist. I thought Latinx, Asian, Middle Easterners, and Natives could not be racist because they did not have power. And then he goes on to tear down, and he has all the receipts and citations, you know, of an academic. And he says, the powerlessness defense strips black policymakers of their power. And he talks about how it strips black billionaires, of which there are 11, of their power. And black millionaire families, of which he says there are 380,000 black millionaire families in the United States. He says it strips them of their power. Now, what he does not say, and I'm going to insert here, okay, is that if you allow people to, if people are, when you have people in the power structure now who are from a background, we're going to use race here, that are not traditionally from the power structure, okay? And you say that they don't have power. You give them a pass and not do anything. Okay, think about Clarence Thomas. If anybody is platformed as much as Clarence Thomas, a lifetime appointment on the most powerful court in the land, he could say whatever he wants, okay? All right? But he's the silent justice. Now, this may be because he's an authentic conservative, all right? And he actually believes all this stuff that got him into power, all right? And it might be that these 11 black billionaires are they're not particularly concerned about, you know, racial equality. It's just not something they want to do. But the idea that only white people can be racist because white people have all the power, and that no person of color, specifically no black people, can be racist because they have no power, is something that I always thought was not true. Okay.
I would say demonstrably false.
Yeah, demonstrably false. And Kendi, you know, goes out of his way to demonstrate that. All right. And I think that, and I think it's a pretty courageous thing for a person in his position to do, because, you know, he's my age. He's an up and coming academic.
He's not old enough to be a tenured professor.
Yeah. He has something to lose. But you know, he picks this. And I think that this is what he authentically believes. Now, I want to say, okay, like, I do think that white people on average have more power than black people, and have more power than your average person of color. So analyzing, so I would say that the racial prejudice of white people is probably more powerful than the racial prejudice of non-whites. Now, that's not true in all contexts, because power is a contextual phenomenon, okay? But so I can see why this definition that Mendez-Rose articulates and that Oluwo articulates, I can see why that came to be. But when you merge that with something as toxic as cancellation culture, like the second you step out of line, people basically try to destroy your life publicly. I think that it's really unhealthy. And I think that it really breaks down any chance of progress in terms of building a coalition to actually get the type of policies enacted that would actually help address systemic racism.
I would encourage Mr. James Mendez Hodes to move to Japan for a year and tell me that Japanese people are incapable of racial prejudice. He will be the object of racial prejudice, and it won't be because of his Asian heritage.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that's just one of those things. Yeah. So those are the two or three real hotspots that really stood out to me about this book that made me want to write to you about it and made me want to talk to you about it on your show here. And there's a lot more to it.
Yeah, there is. For example, he talks about racism, which is very specific to the belief that the lighter the skin, the better.
Colorism, yes.
Yeah. Yes. What is colorism beyond what I just said there?
Okay. So, I'll start with his definition of colorism, okay? Mm-hmm. And then I'll talk about a little bit about my experiences of it, okay? So, and my understanding of it. So, he says, chapter 9 is called color, okay? He talks about, and the definition he opens it up with is colorism, a powerful collection of racist policies that lead to inequities between light people and dark people, supported by racist ideas about light people and dark people. Then he defines color anti-racism as a powerful collection of anti-racist policies that lead to equity between light people and dark people, supported by anti-racist ideas about light and dark people. So he is talking about what's called colorism, and it's sort of a racial hierarchy that has existed, from my understanding, within the African-American community, but I'm going to say not just in the African-American community, okay, where the lighter you are, which is to say the whiter you are, the more desirable you are, the more intelligent you are perceived to be, the more likely you are to be successful, okay? Eddie Murphy used to do a lot of, Charlie Murphy, Eddie Murphy's brother,
yes,
did a whole bunch of jokes on the Chappelle Show about how, like, when him and his brother first showed up in Hollywood, they were the darkest people there. You know, all of the black celebrities were extremely light-skinned. Okay, and you can look at a lot of historically famous and contemporarily famous, celebrities of African heritage, and they all tend to have very light skin. And when you look at, I'm going to be very cautious here, but I'm assuming that does correlate strongly with social success. All right. Now, Candy talks about being at a historically black university. All right. And the what falls under the tent of black in the United States is extremely broad, right? Because it's basically anybody with African ancestry, all right? And he talks about his lighter skinned roommate, and about how this guy just like seemed bred for success. He'd been part of this whole network of like light skinned networking and privilege that he was completely unaware of, that didn't exist, and how this kid was primed for law school. And Candy talks about how he took to wearing hazel-colored contacts. So he has brown eyes, but he wore contact lenses that would make him look more white. And this is, and he talks about the contradictions that he feels as a black man at this, or he recognizes existed. He says, quote, "I wanted to be black, but didn't want to look black." All right? So when I was in the Dominican Republic, this was totally the case. Like Dominican ancestry is mostly Spanish ancestry mixed with African ancestry. Okay. And the social hierarchy is like all the people up top are sometimes, if not completely pure Spanish ancestry, mostly pure Spanish ancestry. And the people at the bottom, they are often, but not universally so, if not pure African ancestry, primarily African ancestry, right? And this is also true in places like this sort of colorism is true in places where there is no African ancestry. Like skin lightening creams are huge in like China, in South Asia, like the Indian subcontinent, okay? And things like that.
I think in those cases, it's likely that darker skin just implies that you're working class, that you have to work labor out in the sun, and you'd rather be, you know, of a higher class.
Yeah. That may be the case, but it does appear, but it's really hard to disentangle that from when, like, the Indian subcontinent literally was under white rule for a couple hundred years. You know, like, it's really hard to disentangle that. And there's also the Indian caste system in which, like, you know, there are literal hierarchies of ancestry. Like, okay, so really weird sidebar, but you know the Hindu deity Krishna?
Yes.
Right? Okay, so Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita, if I get that wrong, all right? He's explicitly described as having dark skin. Okay, but because Hinduism is the religion of the powerful in India, Krishna is not, he can't be depicted as having light skin, okay, or white skin rather, because it says he has dark skin. So, but they don't want him to have brown skin because he would look like an untouchable, somebody,
right.
So what do? They paint him blue.
Yep.
Yeah, he was dark blue. That's the way we do it.
So, you know, when you talk about the skin tone hierarchy within the African American community, I immediately go to a book that I read in college, "Their Eyes Were Watching God" by Zora Neale Hurston.
Yeah, that's a great book.
Yeah, I was just reviewing the plot synopsis on Wikipedia. So the main character, her name is Janie, mm-hmm. She's relating the tale. And she's in her 40s as the narrator, but she starts mm-hmm. the tale with her sexual awakening in her teens. And she was raised by her grandmother. Her grandmother had been a slave mm-hmm. and had been raped by a white slave owner and had a mixed race child who mm-hmm. was Janie's mother. Janie's mother was raped by a school teacher. And the
fucking hell.
Yeah.
It's so dark. Even in the plot synopsis, man.
Right.
But keep going. Oh my God.
The plot synopsis doesn't say whether the teacher was white or black, but
okay.
If the teacher was white, then
yeah.
Janie's, I mean, we already know she has lighter than normal skin. She might have very white skin.
Yeah.
And she ends up marrying the black mayor of a black town who only wanted her because she had such light skin. And she was she was arm candy. She was a trophy wife for him.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I remember a conversation that she has with another light-skinned woman in the book where this other light-skinned woman was saying, you know, we should just class off unto ourselves and not associate with these Negroes.
Like, Candy talks about that explicitly. He talks about, like, that in another chapter. So,
which to me, you know, I've mentioned this a lot, but I see this as an example of last place avoidance. People who are very low in a power hierarchy would rather give power to people at the top than to see the people just below them raised up to their level, because then they would be at the very bottom. And they'd rather be second to the bottom there rather than at the bottom, even if it means increasing the power of those above them.
Yeah, you're 100% right. And like that you're 100% right. And he Candy acknowledges this in his book. He doesn't use the same line. He doesn't use the phrase last place avoidance, but that's what he's talking about when he talks about this culture hierarchy. He reviews that that classic Chris Rock routine, you know, the blacks versus N-words routine. You've heard it? Yes.
Oh, yeah. Chris Rock is you know, he's perpetually the target of cancellation.
Yeah, but he's I guess he's basically a tenured comedian at this point.
And he's rich. I mean, if he never works again, he's okay.
Yeah, exactly. He might not be psychically okay, but he's not gonna like die in the street, you know?
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So he
or
talks
he
about
have
that.
To trade his labor for money.
Exactly. He doesn't have to go back to being a UPS driver, you know, unless he invested all of his money really badly. Who knows? Yes. But this is something that, you know, that Candy talks about. Yeah. So he also talks about something that reminded me of something you talked about in your podcast. He talks about, and you kind of hinted at it at the top of the conversation, which is ethnic racism. All right. Do you want to hear about ethnic racism?
Yes.
All right. So ethnic racism, a powerful collection of racist policies that lead to inequity between racialized ethnic groups and are substantiated by racist ideas about racialized ethnic groups. Right.
Now, can you strip out some sort of specialized vocabulary there and try to put that into
yes.
Okay. More so, colloquial English.
So the word racialized means, from my understanding, it means when you've had the word race attached to your group. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now he talks about ethnic racism in his own life. He talks about being a racist towards clowning on the African kid. He grew up in New York and there's like, you know, an immigrant from, I believe, Ghana. Okay. And he talks about how this guy's black and he's black. Okay. But him and his native born black friends are just clowning on this African kid all the time, saying, hey, do you eat monkey meat? Did you live in a hut and hunt with a spear? That type of stuff. Okay. So that's his example of ethnic racism. Okay. So they were viewing, and this is part of my criticism of the book, this is clearly a type of prejudice, but you have to use a weird word like racialized to fit it in the framework. Like, you have to racialize an ethnic group before you could even talk about that prejudice. So it is a little clunky. But like, you've talked about this previously, like on the podcast, like the fluctuating definition of whiteness over time and about the very real, very documented anti-Irish sentiment.
Yes, the Irish were very eager to become white, and they grasped it with both hands when it was offered to them.
Exactly. But prior to that, you can find people referring to the Irish race, okay?
Right. No, because dogs are Irish allowed.
Exactly. Like, because, you know, race is not a real thing. You can just lay it on whoever. And so you can just say, like, this subgroup of white people over here who had the misfortune of being born on a poor island, like, they're a different race now. Right, like, my family is not Irish in ancestry, but we are Polish in ancestry. All right, and so my family would, under the language, using the language of Candy, have experienced anti-Polish ethnic racism. Right, my uncles grew up being called a dumb Polak. Right. And since moving to Pittsburgh, I discovered they have a different Polish slur called bohunk, which I didn't know.
Oh, I've never heard that.
Yeah. I think it's, I don't know where it comes from, but yeah, it's like Polak bohunk. Like, it's just like, wow. Okay. So, you know, I'm not trying to say like, I don't feel discriminated against in the city of Pittsburgh, like that sort of anti-Polish sentiment historically documented doesn't really exist. And I'm not trying to say it's the same thing as Black people have experienced historically, okay? Now, the anti-Irish stuff is weirder because, like, there are documented Irish slaves, right? Like, literal, not indentured servants, like, literal slaves, people bought and sold at slave markets. And this is probably, I think, a good capstone to the conversation where he talks about, because, like, where Kendi says race comes from. And this is probably, I don't know if it's the most controversial thing, but it's probably where it's most open to weakness or criticism, because he says race is entirely a construct of capitalism, all right? He says that his definition of race is, quote, a power construct of collected or merged differences that lives socially. So he's saying
that race— Would you say that again?
A power construct of collected or merged differences that lives socially. So most people now will say that race is a social construct, meaning that it's not a biological category, meaning that although there are slight biological variations between human individuals, you know, you might have a little bit, your skin might be a little bit different, or your hair might be a little bit different, or your eyes might be a little bit different, that those don't actually add up to anything. They're not actually going to predict your real abilities. Being, you know, being a Native American is not the same thing as being an orc. You're not a literal different species. You're just a little tiny different, okay? But so we've so most people would say we've constructed a social category, right, of race around those differences. What Kendi is saying is that this is about power. Now, what he does is he goes back to he documents the first, what he says is the first emergence of the modern usage of the word race. And he goes back and documents what he believes is the first modern conception of race. And then he goes back beyond that to actual slavery. So what he says is that the original slave markets, they were bad. He does not say that they were good. But he says that they were not constructed along lines of perceived race. The original slave markets were multiracial slave markets. Whoever they got that they could capture and make do work, they captured and made do work. All right? But it's only when you start to move into the new world, all right, that the modern conception of race begins, all right? He says that the modern slave trade along racial lines began not long after Columbus. Now, because I was in the Peace Corps in the DR, I know a little bit about the history of Columbus, right? So they land on Hispaniola, okay? Like, and there's a native population there. They were called the Taino, right? They're just done. They're just gone. It was a Holocaust. But before they just murdered these people to death and committed genocide upon them, they attempted to enslave them, okay? But the problem is when you attempt to enslave a native population, first of all, it's their home turf.
Right.
They know the land better than you. They can always go and hide. Now, in Hispaniola, that was really difficult because it was an island, right? People attempted to resist, and they resisted successfully. So the conquistadors, they just murdered them all. And what do? They import people that are not native to that place, don't know the culture, don't know the land, right? And who could never blend in with the local population. And so this is, of course, Africans. All right?
There's also a disease aspect to it in that Europeans were highly susceptible to malaria and yellow fever and dengue fever and other diseases which were just ran rampant in the Caribbean and in the southern part of the North American continent. And there were populations in Western Africa which had much higher resistance to those diseases than did Europeans or people from, you know, other parts of Africa. And
So
they became ideal slaves to capture in Africa and take to put to work in the New World.
Yeah, dengue is still a thing. Like, I got dengue in 2016 because I don't have, you know, I don't have immunity. You know, I do probably now, having had dengue fever, which is terrible, by the way. But yeah, you're totally right. So here's where he goes. And he says that, like, race, as we understand it, only emerged to justify this essentially market practice. They view these human beings as an ideal product to be forced to labor for a variety of reasons. And everything about race that comes since then is just garbage. You know, all the fake biology, you know, all the fake cultural hierarchy, you know, it's all just garbage. And he says we can leave it behind, which is, I think it's liberatory. Now, what he says in that, and this is a challenging thing. He says, because these hierarchies have these power constructs, he would say, have existed so long, they've kind of come to take on a life of their own. And we do need to use them to attempt to redress the historical cause, okay? Like identifying somebody as black in, 1600 probably didn't tell you anything about an individual, all right? But in the United States, there are certain, you know, statistical outcomes that are strongly correlated with with power construct categories like race. And so this is why where anti-racism comes in. That's why all of his definitions of anti-racist orient around policy. So he says, you're a racist if you express these ideas and support them, and you are an anti-racist if you actively support policies that run ideas and policies that run contrary to these established ideas.
I want to read something. There is a clergyman named Charles Kingsley, British man, born 1819, died 1875. And I only know of him because of something, you know, his particular dislike for the Irish and a particular thing, you know, of a phrase that he coined. So I'm reading from Wikipedia here. Kingsley was accused of racism toward the Roman Catholic Irish poor and described Irish people in rabid and virulent terms. Visiting County Sligo, Ireland, he wrote a letter to his wife from Machree Castle in 1860. Quote, I am haunted by the human chimpanzees I see along the hundreds of miles of this horrible country.
Oh,
to see white chimpanzees is dreadful. If they were black, one would not see it so much. But their skins, except where tanned by exposure, are as white as ours, close quote.
Ethnic racism is its finest.
Yeah, that's 1860.
Yeah, yeah. 1860, which is not that long ago, you know?
No, but it is... It's well after the, you know, particular biological suitability of black populations for slave work in the New World was known and had been in practice for a couple hundred years that, you know, a British clergyman has this particular attitude, that he absolutely hates the Irish and he's very bothered by the fact that they have white skin.
Yeah. And so this idea that Kendi says was created essentially to justify the enslavement of black people was weaponized against other white people by white people. And Kendi, to his enormous credit, identifies that as a type of racism, period. He doesn't identify anti-Irish racism specifically, but his framework, as articulated and carefully explained, all right, completely allows for that to be called racism, which it was.
So I'm tempted to read the whole book now and not just rely on the summary that I took in. I took in a 25-minute summary on YouTube this morning.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I do like the nuance that Kendi is bringing to the conversation. And as you say, he's brave to do it because he's not insulated from cancel culture. And what he's saying is likely to enrage leftist race fundamentalists.
Yeah.
Who wield enormous power in academia.
You know, you're right. I'm inclined to agree with you, but I'm surprised that it hasn't happened yet, but also to the extent that he is celebrated. Like, I mean, he's literally the director of a policy center. I'm sure that's a contract for as long as the policy center has funding. But his gig now, as I understand it, is popularizing this framework and attempting to and directing research to build out these policies that he says are required. And that's where I think it's probably going to get real problematic, you know, like policies are imperfect blunt instruments, right? But that's what I wonder, I put this in the email that I sent you. I wonder how many people have actually read the book and put in the time to really think through the framework as it has been articulated.
I hope enough that he's, you know, made some decent money off the book. Book sales are not typically where people earn their living anymore, unless they're, you know, Stephen King or they're on Oprah's book club selection.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, I think there's the last couple chapters are very, very personal in the book. And they don't really have definition. They don't have definitions the way he does. He talks about his personal story, okay? And he talks about his personal story in every chapter. He uses his himself primarily as an example of experiencing racism and perpetuating racism. But the last chapters are just about like him meeting his wife, and they both suffering from cancer and beating cancer and surviving it. Like, this guy's my age and he's already had cancer and recovered from it. And his wife, who I presume is my age, has already had cancer and recovered from it. So I think there might be a certain level of fearlessness about this guy. Like, he's literally almost died. His wife has literally almost died. Like, what else can you do? You know?
Yeah. When you've stood before a god, you don't fear a king.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And so he closes, and when he's reaching for a metaphor, he likens racism as a cancer. He says our society has racism in the same way that his body had cancer, and that the diagnosis of his cancer was particularly bad. One of those things where they're like, dude, you're probably going to die. But he did not die. And so he thinks that our society has terminal racism. But just as his cancer was allegedly terminal, he thinks that he is optimistic enough to believe that we can cure this disease, this social disease.
You know, I'm glad that that's his vision and that he believes it's achievable. It seems like quite the stretch from where I'm standing.
Yeah. I'm not super optimistic, dude. Like, I'm really appreciative of his work and the bravery he's shown. And I'm really appreciative of your time today to process this and kind of think through this with you. All right. And, although this is a very brave, very, just such a great work, you know, and I think it's something that we definitely need right now. I'm not sure that this is the framework that's going to win out, you know, especially if people can't be bothered to read the goddamn book.
Well, I will repeat, there is a fairly thoroughgoing 25-minute summary of the audiobook on YouTube.
All right.
I'll link to it in the show notes for this episode. It's quite clear that, you know, you're not just throwing off ideas off the top of your head, that you came into this conversation with some serious preparation. So I do appreciate that.
Yeah. Well, I will tell you, okay, I do want this under my usual anonymized name, okay? But I take this very seriously, and I do try to be very aware of the situation we're in, not just in terms of my own cancelability as a normal person, but also like I am a white dude who has limited experience of this. And so if I do want to talk about this, I need to really make sure I know my shit. Like I really need to digest these ideas and take these ideas seriously before I talk about them. So, I mean, your show is worth it, the preparation, but I also think these ideas themselves are worth it.
Before we go, I just mention I'm going to have very little introduction and postscript to this conversation because it's over an hour and, you know, it'll be a show unto itself.
Okay.
Surely, you know, maybe nobody in the CROM Vault audience, it's a fairly small audience and there are people who've been with me for a long time. They won't necessarily take offense that two white guys are talking about issues around race. But surely if this, you know, conversation did leak out into the general public, that would be a major criticism. And I just want to say, I have, you know, black people that I know that I have talked to for the podcast on other topics, and I am reluctant to approach them to make them a representative of black people so that I can have a conversation about racism.
Yeah. And that's fair. Like, I mean, it's if somebody wants to talk to you about it, you know, like great, but yeah, like you don't want to essentialize somebody. I can recall some of the individuals you've had on and they were black people, but you and that did enter into the conversation, but they were talking about a lot of other stuff, you know. What was the guy, JFK, James Felton Keith, was it? Like that guy, like had a lot of ideas and they were not particularly around race. And for you to call him up and say, hey, you happen to be black, will you be my black expert, you know, that's not super cool. And like, I am not a Black expert. let's make that clear. But I have tried to engage very seriously with the ideas of this one. We'll just say philosopher. Okay, and I hope that I've done a decent job of representing his work.
As far as I can tell, you have, but again, I'm no expert. But I'm pretty sure the conversation will be of use to the listeners.
Okay, I really hope so. That's why I wanted to reach out, because you have been talking just a little bit about race on the edge in part of your discussions of what's going on in the world. And I know you've been hearing from some of your listeners and viewers about it. And I thought, you know what, this might be a good thing to have on Camo's show.
One other thing I'll say, this will be my sort of closing statement, something that I would normally put in the, you know, postscript that I record after the interview. Mm-hmm. I'm still uncomfortable with the binary. In any moment, you're either racist or anti-racist, because in this moment, you know, historical mm-hmm. moment, it is completely unacceptable to be racist. And there are definite material consequences, punishments that will be visited upon you if you are successfully labeled a racist by somebody who doesn't like you.
Yeah, you're right.
And so if I accept that in any given moment, I'm either being a racist or an anti-racist, and I always have to be an anti-racist, and crucially, somebody else is the expert at what it means to be an anti-racist, that I have to defer to their authoritarian pronouncements about what I can say or do to be an anti-racist. And if I don't follow those pronouncements, then I'm a racist. Well, mm-hmm. that's where I push back. That's where I say, I reject your authority, you know, to make those assertions. Yeah, you can make them, but I don't take them as authoritative.
Okay. Yeah, I totally feel that. Let me just pop a question here. What if Kendi said you were being racist? Like, he'd probably be pretty nice about it. He seems like an understanding guy. But what if the literal subject matter expert? Would that be different or no?
You know, if he included a link to my website and his criticism was widely circulated, that would be good for me, because I've established myself as somebody who absolutely will not put himself in a position of vulnerability, mm-hmm. you know, to people who attempt to cancel and to get people fired, you know, mm-hmm. for not kowtowing to the current orthodoxy.
Yeah.
So for me personally, that would be a boon. You know, if a public figure made a serious attempt to label me a racist, you know, in a public forum, that would just, you know, that would be a boon to me.
Yeah.
But, you know, if I hadn't made a deliberate effort over the course of a couple decades to stake out a living that wasn't dependent on me being acceptable to, you know, the orthodoxy of the leftists, you know, the far fringe, because people get canceled for, you know, or attempts are made to cancel people because they retweeted somebody who once retweeted somebody who had a potentially problematic position on something.
The transitive property of cancellation.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So I kind of threw that out there as a bit of a troll. But remember, like, if Kendi were to label, he would not say you are therefore. He would not say KMO is a racist for all time. He would say KMO did a racist thing in this moment.
Yeah, and you know, potentially he would be correct, but most people who are interested in getting racists fired don't make that distinction.
You're correct.
Is an essential, non-material, unchangeable quality of a person. And if something they say can be interpreted as revealing mm-hmm. that inherent quality, then they're canceled. They're done. They are not.
You got it. You
not
got it.
Respected or associated with, and they certainly aren't allowed to make a living.
You're right. And what you described is very real. And that's why I am not a public figure. I am not, I have no social media. Like, and I have my day job and I work it and I try to engage in productive conversations where I think it is safe to do so.
Yeah, that's a conversational line we can't pursue, but I think it's important that anybody who has a Twitter account is to some extent a public figure, and you are making yourself, you are voluntarily relinquishing your privacy and your ability to claim that you're not a public figure, that you shouldn't be held to the standards of public figures.
Yeah, yeah.
If you have a Twitter account, you're a public figure. At least you have the vulnerabilities of a public figure. You don't necessarily have the voice and the platform of a public figure.
You said it. All right.
It's a lot of vulnerability for, you know, it's like a lottery ticket, you know?
Exactly. The cost benefit analysis for me personally doesn't play out. And honestly, the psychic amount of psychic energy you got to put into that, I would imagine, does not seem worthwhile either. So I look at Twitter, but I do not tweet.
Right. All right. And with that, let me just say I'm KMO. That's KAYEMMO on Twitter. Follow me on Twitter.
I don't care really. I am nobody at Twitter. Nobody. Yes. Don't look for me there. I'm not there.
You are not to be found. All right. Hey, Kevin, thank you very much.
No problem, KMO. Have a good day, man.
All right. That is all for this episode of the podcast. The concluding remarks that I would normally record after the interview, I just included in the interview. As always, I welcome your feedback. You know how to contact me. I will talk to you again soon. Stay well.